The office where the papers grow, she takes a break, drinks another coffee, and she finds it hard to stay awake. It's just another day. It's just another day.
Country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you've read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Well now, good afternoon, everybody. Getting the last second preparations ready here today. Cut it kind of close. Had a little technical glitch here and there, but I think we've got it already. Got my bottle of Pellegrino water. Had to get that opened up. That's what was delaying me here. Couldn't get that lid off of it. I tell you the darndest things, don't I? Hey, I hope you're having a good day today. Here we are at 3 o'clock, and we've got a couple of great guests for you today. I promise you, you will enjoy them both. The first one, I'm not sure exactly what we're going to talk about. Sybil Edmond, all of you know about her and the FBI whistleblowing incident that she's been involved in. That's a very murky subject. This seems the government doesn't want us to know a damn thing about it, quashing her lawsuits and all that. She'd been fired from the FBI. And in the second hour, we're going to have a fascinating guest by the name of Randall Hamoud. Randall is of Lebanese descent. He has written some interesting articles about our rights in the Constitution. He's represented three of the Arab Muslim men who were arrested as material witnesses out in San Diego. On he's just become an outspoken opponent of Bush administration's attack on our fundamental constitutional rights and our war against terrorism. And he's going to talk about how he thinks we're creating new bin Ladens every single day. We'd love to have you join the program today, 888-546-5254. 888-546-5254. Love to have you join us today. Poor Joe. I guess that's the big news today for amongst Democrats anyway. Hey, and before I get started, I want to say a big, big thank you to all the folks, all the Democratic clubs in Lee County, Florida, and Charlotte County, Florida, and Collier County, Florida. All were well represented last night at a big fundraiser we held for Robert Neild, who is running for Congress here against the incumbent, Republican incumbent, Connie Mack. They raised a lot of money last night, and, well, we hope we can make a race of it. We've sure got a great candidate. We know that. And had a guy, I emceed the whole deal last night. It was a lot of fun. Great food down at the Palm Supper Dinner Club. Just great. Fabulous evening. Love evenings like that. Man, the food was good, too. And, of course, got home last night, not too late, in time to turn on and start seeing the election returns come in from Connecticut, and I guess the polls were pretty doggone accurate, weren't they? Late in the last day, I heard a poll that got it down to about 4.5 to 5%, and there she is. So these polls can be pretty doggone accurate. And it appears that poor Joe Lieberman, he's going to keep going, and the Republicans are going to back him. I was wondering when some of the Republicans like Bill Bennett and Mona Sharon and Cliff May and John McLaughlin, when they said they were going to back him, I wondered if they're going to back Cynthia McKinney as well, or do they just back white guys? Just asking. And, of course, I see where the Israelis are going to send their cabinet today voted, 9-0, to send more troops in to Lebanon. They're sure looking for peace there, aren't they? Tony Snow said the vote last night was a defining moment. And, Tony, I've got to agree with you. I think it is a defining moment in American politics. I think that the Democratic Party stood up last night. I think the rank-and-file voters, the netroots, the grassroots, and everybody stood up last night. You see, where this is where they're making a mistake. They think that that's just a Connecticut thing. That's not just a Connecticut thing. Not at all. I think it was the opening salvo in a fight to take back the Democratic Party. And guess who's going to win that party this year? We are. We're going to take it back from the DLC people and the people who think they've been, had an iron-fisted control of the party. I think last night sent out a big message to Democratic candidates all across the country. Hey, let's do what we're supposed to do. Let's not be a kiss-ass Joe Lieberman. And that's exactly, let's face it, that's exactly what Joe Lieberman is. I'm not telling you anything new. I'm not giving you any new opinions. You know where I've stood on Joe Lieberman since day one. I was appalled when Al Gore picked him as a vice presidential running mate. I thought that was the biggest mistake Al Gore ever made in his life, and Joe has proven it to us. He didn't just lose yesterday. Lieberman didn't just lose yesterday because he voted for the war or because he opposes any kind of an immediate pullout from Iraq. There's lots of other liberals that hold those positions, yet they still remain popular, including Hillary Clinton, who also faces a primary challenge from an anti-war leftist, yet she's coasting toward a re-election. In fact, liberals, like other Americans, hold a wide range of views about what to do about Iraq. If a city gets built based on years and years of faulty plans and flawed construction, even the best engineers might not be able to agree on how to fix it. But liberals, and those of you that want to call yourself progressives, and many, many independents and conservatives have really come to agree now that the war has gone badly wrong and that a radical change of course is needed. No more of this stay the course crap. And this new consensus, it took time to gel. It really did. And a lot of liberals started off supporting the war. A lot of them did. I don't know if it was a majority or a lot, but I know a lot of liberals that were behind the war when it started. I never was. You know that. And some of those people believed for years that American efforts would somehow build a stable democracy out of Iraq's many factions. It took years of these bloody photos that you see on the front pages, not often enough on the front pages to suit me, and lots of bleak assessments from the generals and you can see the increasing regional instability. And that doubt and fear by Democrats and some of the people in the middle of the road, it's hardened into some kind of distrust and frustration over the whole thing. And so for almost a year now, more than 60% of the public has disapproved of Bush's handling of the Iraq War. Yet, as the public mood changed, and here's the problem, Lieberman stood still. Even you Lieberman people will have to admit that. He stood still. The public opinion was changing. And many Democrats have rued the day they voted for that resolution to allow Bush to go to war. But Lieberman never changed his stance. You know, here lately he's been saying, well, he was unhappy with what he called a handful of mistakes. But he still held fast to his basic support of Bush's policies. He didn't offer any proposals to stabilize Iraq or reduce anti-American hostility all over the world or to spare the lives of more soldiers. Even that little desperation speech that he gave on Sunday, and that's exactly what it was. It was utter desperation. That was aimed to shore up the wobbly voters that think maybe Iraq is maybe not so bad. He's really showed no inclination whatsoever to rethink the administration's crazy strategies of either stay the course or cut and run. They don't know what to do in the White House. You know they don't. And Lieberman's backed him. Right down the line, he's backed him on that. But that's not the only reason Joe Lieberman got voted out yesterday. We mentioned a few things yesterday. You know, he supported Gonzalez and the torture policy. He supports a non-provoked attack on Iran. He supported the school vouchers. He supported the no child left behind. And as I was reminded last night by a friend we had dinner with last night, and John, I hope you're listening. Met a lovely couple that are good listeners last night, John and Carolyn. But don't forget about the kiss. I hadn't forgotten about the kiss. Lieberman voted to confirm Condoleezza Rice. He went along with every damn thing Bush wanted all along. He's friends with Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity. Those two guys called Democrats terrorists, and Lieberman's friends with them. He doesn't act like an opposition party member. Not at all. He's against universal health care. He's against gay marriage. He voted for John Roberts. So, Joe, let's not be crying in our beer now and saying, oh, they didn't get me because of the war. And you know, he always sounds like he's whining. He always talks like he's whining anyway. That's not it, Joe. That's not it, and you know it. You know, you've got Senators Hillary Clinton and Chuck Schumer and Joe Biden. And they don't any longer prove their mettle by just blandly supporting the administration. They haven't been pulling any punches in their demands for a more effective diplomacy efforts or maybe a more robust homeland security and an end to Bush's failed Middle East policies. I do wish all three of them would come out with categorical denials of Bush's stay the course. I wish they'd all come out and just stand there and say so. They haven't yet. And I'll repeat my policy. I will not back any candidate who voted for the war or voted for it and has not apologized for it. I will not do so. I don't care. I won't. You can talk about committee chairmanships and the majority and all that all you want to. I will not back any candidate who has not apologized for backing this war if they back this war. I will not. I will not back off of that, no matter what. That may be cutting off your nose to spite your face, but I think it's time for some purity in the party, if such a thing is possible. So, for this reason, I don't think liberals need to fear that Lieberman's loss is going to somehow pigeonhole the party into some sort of an identity fashioned by the far left or paint the party as spineless. And the Republicans are already starting this. You know, Ken Mellman's already, oh, they're in trouble now. They're soft on security. Now, you know what? That vote last night against Joe Lieberman was a vote for security of this country. That's exactly what it was. It was a vote to stop this nonsense that's going on around the world, which will ultimately make this nation safer. I'm not talking about appease the bad guys. I'm talking about getting at the roots of the problem and not thinking that we can solve everything down the barrel of a gun. That will no longer work in this world. This world is too small for that. I think this Connecticut outcome shows the kind of decisiveness that voters have been waiting for from the minority party. Liberals, not led by operatives, but by ordinary voters, have finally drawn a clear line. There is room. There's lots of room for a wide range of views on Iraq in the ranks. But the one view they won't abide is the belief that nothing needs to change. You know, to be sure, agreement that Iraq is a mess can't in itself substitute for a foreign policy platform. Liberals are still going to have to come out and explain how they do things differently, and they're not doing a very good job of it. We need a solid message. But the new public view of the war and the resolve for change that Connecticut liberals have shown just might shape the terms of this fall election coming up. going to be interesting to see how this affects the Democratic Party. Very interesting. Because really and truly, yesterday at that ballot box, ordinary Americans did what President Bush and the Congress have refused to do. They started to change the course. Change the course. They started to realize that staying the course is an idiotic, moronic policy with no future. Disaster at the end of the road for stay the course. The reason Ned Lamont defeated three-term Senator Joseph Lieberman was for many, many reasons. But ultimately, the war was the main one. I think you'd have to say that. And Lamont wants to get out of Iraq. Most Americans do agree with Lamont's position on Iraq. On Sunday, some of you saw it, Lamont laid out his Iraq position on ABC's This Week. And just to quote him, if you guess, you're trying to guess where he's at, if you don't know, he says, "We say our frontline troops are going to be out within a year. Then we negotiate with them the terms of how we do that, but it doesn't mean we're deserting the people of Iraq. We're going to be there for humanitarian aid, and we'll be there for reconstruction. We'll be there for political support. But I think it's important to get the very American face off of this occupation and give the Iraqis space to solve this on their own." As far as I'm concerned, I'm right with him on every bit of that. Every word of it. And Joe Lieberman wasn't. So, going to have to cry in your beer. He's gonna show, and already has shown, Lieberman has, just how loyal he has been. You know, many of us have been complaining about his loyalty to the party. I think we now know he has no loyalty to the party whatsoever, because he's now willing to divide the party. He's going to try and take his supporters with him and run in this independent campaign and try and split the vote and still hang on to his precious job in Washington, D.C. You see, the main problem with Joe Lieberman is his entire loyalties, all of them, rest with Joe Lieberman. And I think this action of running as an independent shows us that just as clear as can possibly be. Many within the party are urging him not to do this. Many who backed him last week, Chris Dodd, Bill Clinton, who else? I'm trying to think who else went out there. They're all going to drop off from supporting him now. But he thinks he can pull it off anyway. Well, I'm not going to say good luck, Joe, because I hope you don't have good luck with that. I think you're a rat for running on an independent ticket. In Democratic primaries, and in this Democratic primary, the people have spoken. And ordinarily, for any politician in a primary, when the people have spoken, that's good enough. But it's not good enough for Joe Lieberman now, is it? No. Not at all. Well, we shall see. We shall see what happens. I think we're going to go to a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
Guy James back with you. Hope you'll join the conversation. We're going to have Sabelle Edmond on in just a few minutes. Right at around the bottom of the hour. We'll be getting in contact with her and having her on today. She's a famous FBI whistleblower that so many of you know about. I was just looking at the chat room, and gosh, I'll always say what I'm thinking. And I see Cynthia McKinney is claiming that she's claiming racial issues. She is saying that she somehow got hosed at the ballot box. I got to be honest with you. I did not support Cynthia McKinney in that election. I did not. For my money, she's been an embarrassment. She's not my representative, but I think she was an embarrassment to that district. I don't think she comported herself in the way that a United States Congresswoman should, time after time. So I'm not sad about Cynthia McKinney losing. Now go ahead and flame away if you like, but that's my opinion. And I don't believe in being politically correct. If I'm supposed to say that I'd back Cynthia McKinney, why, I'm sorry, just can't do it. Don't want to do it. I see now that, and we're going to talk about this a little later on in the program, I see now that we are faced with many more troops going into Lebanon. Many more. I can see nothing but trouble as coming from that. Nothing but trouble whatsoever is going to come from that. But I don't think the Bush administration can possibly imagine the trouble that's going to lead to. We were talking last night at the table that I was sitting at. We're talking about the problem that we think that we are using Israel as a proxy. We've noticed they've had troops close to the Syrian border now. They are trying to provoke Syria into some sort of an attack. And if they do, that'll give the good old U.S. of A. all the reasons that they need to attack Iran and Syria. That's what it's looking at like to me. What do you think? 888-546-5254. 888-546-5254. I hope you'll give us a call and let us know what you happen to think about anything we have to say today, or give us your own opinions about anything. Well, not about anything. We'd like to keep some a little bit of control on the show anyway. I did find it interesting that many people within the Republican Party, and I think it just proves all along what many of us have been saying, that Joe is more of a Republican than a Democrat. Look at how many Republicans are going to his aid now. They're loving this. So, I don't know. I've said all along that I think Joe will change his politics. I really believe he will. It's hard for me to imagine that he could keep a D behind his name. I thought all along that if he did win, he still, once he got back in office again for this next term, if he had won, I thought he would change. I really thought so. Yeah, I'm seeing on the chat room that people are defending Cynthia McKinney. I predicted that Cynthia McKinney, when she got beaten, it was obvious she was going to get beat. I knew that she would claim that she got screwed by the voting machines, and I knew that she would claim that it was racist, although she was running against another black candidate. I knew she would pull out those. I don't like the woman. I don't like the way she acts in Congress. I don't think she's been a good congresswoman whatsoever for her district, and I think she has embarrassed the folks back home many, many times, and I think they finally had enough. I lived in a district when I was in Ohio where our congressman embarrassed us terribly and didn't act the way a congressman ought to, with at least a little bit of dignity and respect. And, well, the congressman got arrested, so, well, so did Cynthia McKinney. I don't know. 888-546-5254 if you'd like to join us. 888-546-5254. And if you've got an opinion on Cynthia McKinney and you'd like to share it, why, give us a call. If you've got an opinion on Joe Lieberman, if you don't agree, give us a call. I happen to think Lieberman losing yesterday was a good thing. The Republicans are trying to convince everybody that it was a bad thing for the Democratic Party. That's all I've heard today. Oh, this is the beginning of the end for the Democrats. The infighting has started. No. I think it's the beginning of the coming together of the Democrats. I really do. I think Democrats, now that they see an incumbent senator go by the wayside, at least in a primary, I think Democrats will start to come together now more than ever before. Spoke to the group last night and talked about that. I think that we really are. I know we've said this before, but it's true once again that this is the most important election in our nation's history. If we allow these neocons to continue running this country the way they have, I think they need to go. I think they're very dangerous. I agree with people that say that George Bush is one of the most dangerous men in the world. I most definitely agree. I'm going to try and hunt down that joke somebody sent me yesterday about George Bush. One of them was that, did you hear George Bush is writing a book? He's got all the pages numbers. Now he's got to do is fill in the rest. Yeah. Hey, give us a call. 866-546-5254. 866-546-5254. We hope you'll give us a call. We're going to have just a couple of minutes until we come up on the bottom of the hour, and then we will get a hold of our guest and called and confirmed it with her just a little while ago, so we know she's... And I guess I must have said the wrong phone number a moment ago. I must have said 888. I meant 866. 866-546-5254. If you're in Washington, D.C., you can call our Washington Bureau. It won't cost you anything, 202-370-6153. And if you happen to be in the Phoenix, Arizona area, you can call our Phoenix number, toll-free, 623-444-5252. Well, we're going to take a quick break and get a hold of our guest, and we'll be back with you in just a moment.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many years can a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? Yes, and how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Yes, and how many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many times must a man look up before he can see the sky? Yes, and how many ears must one man have before he can hear people cry? Yes, and how many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base.
Oh, it's true. It's true.
Call Guy James now. 1-866-546-5254.
Hey, and we're back. Thanks, everybody, for sticking with us through the break. Glad to have all of you along with us on this Wednesday afternoon. I hope it's a nice day where you're at. It certainly is here in Southwest Florida as well today. So, you know, I want to introduce somebody now that all of you know we were going to have. I've certainly told you enough times that we're going to have Sabelle Edmonds with us. She's a very, very interesting person. If you get a chance to read her bio, I hope you'll do it. She's the founder and director of the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition. It's a nonprofit organization dedicated to aiding national security whistleblowers. She has a very interesting background. And Sabelle, are you with us?
Yes.
Hey, thank you for being on the program today.
Thank you for inviting me.
I was looking through your bio the other day. You have one of the more interesting bios I think I ever read, and especially when I came to the part that said you're fluent in Turkish, Farsi, and Azerbaijani.
Correct.
Well, how did you happen to come by those three languages? Tell us a little bit about your background with that.
Sure. I cannot take much credit for knowing and being fluent in these languages. But originally, I'm from Turkey, and my parents, they moved to Iran during Shah's regime because my father obtained a position as a surgeon in one of the largest hospitals in Tehran. So we moved there during Shah's regime, and I spent about 8 years over there and attended the elementary school. And as you know, the revolution took place, and we were unable to leave the country and go back to Turkey and take our belongings with us. So 2 years after the revolution, we just had to escape the country and leave everything behind, our home, our cars, our properties. And then I continued my education in Turkey and attended the middle school and high school there. And my father's background, his family, they are Azerbaijani. And I learned to speak Azerbaijani, and I became fluent in Azerbaijani by just being around my father's family. So that's how I got to know those languages.
That's the reason that you got on with the FBI?
Well, actually, there is a long story behind that, but to make it short...
That's one thing, and if you allow me to interrupt you for a moment. I was sitting at a big dinner last night with a bunch of people, and they were asking me who was going to have the program today. And I told them that I was going to have you on, and just about everybody recognized your name, and they knew that you'd had something to do with some sort of a whistleblowing incident, and I started to explain it to them, and of course, you know, it's a rather long story. And some of them listened to me, and I think their eyes started to glaze over as I was getting into the meat of it. So I would like for you to do that and take as long as you'd like. But as you know, your story is a fascinating story, and some people just can't get the gist of it. So if you could explain it, why, that would be great.
Sure. In 1990s, I was working as a court-appointed special advocate. I represented sexually abused children who were removed from their homes and placed with foster care families. And also, I was pursuing my degrees at George Washington University in criminal justice and psychology. And I had applied for an internship position with the FBI in 1998 in any department that dealt with crimes against children. And once they received my application, they responded to it by saying that they found my linguistic skills of interest and asked me to go to their headquarters and take proficiency tests and exams on these languages. And I really didn't want to become a language specialist, but I did it. I said, well, maybe this is one way to get to where I really wanted to get to in the future. So I took those exams, and they said they had to conduct intensive background check because all language specialists for the Bureau have to have top secret clearance because you're dealing with all these intelligence, raw intelligence, under counterintelligence, counterterrorism, criminal investigations. And they said it would take about 15 months or so to conduct this thorough background investigation in order for me to receive my top secret clearance. And this was in 1998, guys. I didn't hear back from them until January 2001. And by then, my life had changed, and I was not even planning to go and work for the FBI at that point. But I just called them out of curiosity to find out what happened with my TSC, top secret clearance. And lo and behold, they told me that in 1999, the Bureau had lost applications and test results and documentations on 150 language specialist applicants, 150 people. I said, well, how could the FBI lose these files? I mean, this is the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Yeah, that doesn't inspire confidence, does it?
Absolutely, and you had my tax return and my bank account information. They apologized. They said they would put an expedited background check. I said, look, I'm not even interested to work for you at this point, so I hung up. 3 days after September 11, I received this call from the FBI headquarters saying that they had finished the background investigation regardless of my refusal, and they were so badly in need of translators because of what had occurred 3 days earlier, and they were desperate for language specialists with my skills, which is Farsi and Turkish and Azerbaijani, which also includes all these Central Asian countries, you know, Uzbekistan and Chechnya and Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, etc. I said, well, I was already busy with another job and also going to school for my master's degrees. And they said, well, come and work for us as a contractor, and you can determine your hours, even if you could give us 15 hours a week. Listen, we are desperate. It was, I mean, how could you say no? Here we had gone through this horrendous terrorist attack, and 3,000 lives had been lost, and we were under this threat. And how could you say, no, I can't come and serve my country when I can, when I can contribute in some ways? So I received my TSC, and a week after September 11, in 2001, I started working for the Bureau. And immediately, within the first 2 months after I started to work there, I came across some major cases that were being covered up. Some of them had to do with certain counterintelligence information received under counterintelligence operations that were 100% related to terrorist activities that had occurred before September 11 and on September 11. They were not being transferred to the counterterrorism division because of the pressure by the Pentagon and the State Department. They claimed that this would hurt certain sensitive diplomatic relations. For example, if those countries that their people in some ways were involved happened to be from Pakistan or Saudi Arabia or Turkey or some of these Central Asian countries, and they were not part of this axis of evil, the so-called axis of evil, they didn't want to pursue those leads and those investigations because they were our so-called allies. Also, another important case that I stumbled upon had to do with certain translators were granted top secret clearance, and without having their background investigations done, and later on, at least in one case, we found out that this individual actually used to work for one of the top targets of FBI counterterrorism investigation. And she had ongoing relationship with those targets. And somehow she was given the CSC and was working and was in charge of translating information, raw data, raw intelligence coming from those targets. And this was after we reported this, we thought the FBI, and this is when I say we, it was the agents I worked with, we reported this case to the FBI headquarters, and instead of investigating this espionage case, they just wanted to cover it up because this was right after this big scandal with Robert Hansen's case, and the Bureau didn't want to face any kind of scandal or embarrassment saying that they haven't fixed their internal security system, and they are allowing the targets of investigation actually obtaining jobs with the FBI. So to make the long story shorter, I ended up being the messenger who delivered these reports that the Bureau didn't want to hear anything about, and the State Department and the Pentagon didn't want any of these issues or cases to become public. So instead of investigating these cases and pursuing these cases, they chose to come after me. First, they came to my house, they busted my home, and they removed my home computer, which I shared with my husband. They said that they were suspecting of me sharing some of this information with the Congress, of all the people with the Congress. And at that point, Guy, I was not sharing any information outside the FBI. I was trying to address these issues, report them internally within the FBI's headquarters and Office of Professional Responsibility. So they took my home computer away, they tore it apart, and lo and behold, they didn't find anything. Next, 10 days later, they issued an order and told me I had to go and take a polygraph test, and I was under investigation.
Now, so now let me stop you for a moment. Is it only you? Is it anybody else that's working with you at this time? There's other people that had knowledge of what you have there because you had spoken to them about it, and you're the only one being investigated?
Correct, because I was the only one pursuing the case and reporting it.
Okay.
The other ones were more experienced with the Bureau, and they knew that they didn't want to go and get into trouble, as that's how they put it. So it was basically me. Even the agents that initially supported the case and put their names on my initial report, they backed off and they said, look, you know, this is a mess. This is going to be this huge can of worms, and just let's leave it alone. And one of them was 2 years away from his retirement, and he didn't want to lose that retirement. The other one was a single, he was the single provider for his family. His wife didn't work. He had two babies. And he didn't want to risk his career. That's how he put it. So it ended up being me, all by myself, going and submitting to this excruciating polygraph test for hours. And lo and behold, I passed the polygraph test with no glitch. And I also had these commendation letters from all the agents that I had worked with on various projects, counterterrorism, counterintelligence. The Bureau was not able to find anything with my performance issues. They couldn't find anything in my computer. They couldn't find anything with the polygraph test. They went ahead and they fired me anyway on March 22, 2002. And they just gave me this sheet of paper that said I was being terminated solely for the convenience of the government. That was only one line. I was being fired in order for the government to feel convenient.
Convenient? That's a new one. I've never heard of anybody using that kind of language in a dismissal statement.
Neither had the Congress or the Inspector General's office. After I was fired, I said, okay, I'm going to pursue all the what they now refer to appropriate channels.
But you know, Sibel, they're right. It was convenient for them, wasn't it?
Yes, but I guess I didn't end it there because
yes.
They expected me to get intimidated and go away and get disgusted, you know, with
of
this
course.
Whole case. And what I did was I said, okay, I'm going to pursue this by, you know, by going through the so-called channels. What are those channels, guys? I went to the appropriate committees within the Senate and the House. I went to the intelligence committees for both House and the Senate I went to the Judiciary Committee for both House and the Senate. I provided, appropriate people within the appropriate committees with documents and information about the case. I went to the executive branch. I went to the Department of Justice's own Inspector General's office. I did the same thing with them. I also pursued my case with the court, our judicial system. And as you know, since then, since March 22, 2002, I am considered the most gagged person in the United States history. They have invoked, the government has invoked the state secret privilege twice in my case. Once to basically stop all the court process in my case, and we appealed it to the appellate court and to the Supreme Court, and they said they were going to uphold the state secret privilege. They also gagged the Congress, and this is illegally gagging the Congress, by retroactively classifying all the comments, all the statements, all the documentation that the Senate Judiciary Committee had put out on my case on their website. And this information was available out there on their website for 2 years. Yet, in May 2004, the government went and gagged the Congress. They had them pull out all those documents from their website, and they issued this order saying you cannot make any comments on Sybil Edmonds' case. So they gagged the Congress. They stopped all the court process by invoking the state secret privilege. And the IG report ended up getting classified, and to this day they have released only less than 10% of their findings, which is incredible enough that all my allegations were confirmed and supported by other witnesses and documents, and that the only reason the Bureau had fired me was due to my whistleblowing activity. Here is Department of Justice's own Inspector General issuing a report saying this is why I was fired, and everything that I had said had been confirmed. Yet, here I am, 4.5 years later, with a Congress that has accepted this illegal gag order so willingly, with the courts refusing to fulfill their responsibility under our Constitution, and with the main media not really pursuing these important issues that has, you know, that had implications on all of us. I remember getting outside this court after we were excluded from the hearing when the government argued its part, and we, the plaintiff, my attorneys and I, had to leave the courtroom while the government argued this case. I came out of the court, and to the few reporters who were there, I said, you think this is about one case, about one whistleblower, one FBI translator. This is about all of you. If they get away with this state secret privilege and they are successful in this, they're going to come after you, and they're going to go after a lot of people with this so-called state secret privilege. I was the first victim of the state secret privilege, guy. Since my case, the administration has invoked the state secret privilege 24 times. Recently, on this NSA illegal eavesdropping case, on the illegal detaining of this German citizen, in Arar's case in Canada that the person they held illegally, and also have been going after the reporters for reporting what they are supposed to be reporting. So what I told them 2 years ago is coming true, and we are seeing the results of what they started 4 years ago with one case today, right now.
Well, now, Ashcroft was the first one to kind of quash what you're doing, and you've gotten no, and since Gonzalez came into office, you haven't gotten any redress from him as well. Is that correct?
Absolutely not, because Ashcroft was successful in preventing the court procedures from moving forward. So once the court issued their decision saying that, well, the government is saying that even if Ms. Edmonds is right in her allegations, the issues involved would hurt certain U.S. sensitive diplomatic relations and U.S. foreign business relations. And I want to emphasize this. I am being gagged, my due process has been taken away, and I was fired in order to preserve certain U.S. foreign business relations.
Mm-hmm.
And the court saying we have to agree.
That's an amazing story, and as you might understand, Those of you that have heard what Sabell just said, why it is difficult to sit down at a table with someone and explain the whole thing, not being in her shoes. It's an amazing story. As someone sent me an email when I had announced that you were going to be on the program, and they sent me a little article along with it. I'm trying to see. I can't remember where this came from. Singularity. Anyway, it says, long after we all forget Plame and Wilson and Clark, the other high-level national security whistleblowers, Edmund's story will be the one I still want to hear. And it goes on to mention during there about the American Turkish consul and Valerie Plame and Ambassador Wilson's involvement in that. Do you know anything about that?
I can provide you with some information that has already become public via this information being provided to this Vanity Fair reporter, David Rose, by certain people within the Congress and the FBI. And that was, the article came out in August 2005, and certain congressional officials and current FBI agents familiar with the case, they told the magazine that some of these organizations that were involved in these illegal activities related to the September 11 attack were American Turkish Council, which is this lobbying firm for Turkey and Central Asian countries here in Washington, D.C., and another organization, American Turkish Association. Interestingly enough, that is where Valerie Plame met her husband, Joe Wilson, in 1997. She went to one of the functions held in Washington, D.C. As an analyst for Brewster Jennings. And we don't know why she was there, but we know that Turkey has played a major role and still is playing a major role in nuclear black market activities. They use their access here in the U.S. via people they have on the payroll from several nuclear agencies, and also some of their people within in the Pentagon. And then they sell it to the highest bidder. Now, be it that highest bidder can be Pakistan or it can be North Korea. In some cases, certain Turkish officials were arrested in 2000 for providing this information and aiding Libya in their nuclear black market activities. So that has become public. And also individuals such as Mark Grossman, who used to be the ambassador, U.S. ambassador in Turkey in 1990s, and later the assistant deputy secretary in the State Department, and his involvement with ATC and some of these Turkish organizations, and also the fact that Richard Perle and Douglas Feith, they established in 1989 this lobbying group called the International Advisors, Inc., and they registered as foreign agents for Turkey, and they were registered with the State Department under foreign agents with Turkey. And this was during the time that Perle was still working for the Pentagon, and this was a huge conflict of interest. And the fact that through this lobbying firm, they provided a lot of classified information to both Turkey and Israel, and of course Franklin's involvement in these activities, which has not yet become really public. And again, if this case were to move forward, we would have a lot of these informations becoming public, and our people would know about these individuals and their roles in terms of not serving our country, but having their loyalties to other, either governments or in certain cases, just with greed and large fees that they have obtained from these individuals.
Yeah, the Franklin case having to do with the passing information to the sensitive information to the Israelis. And also, as you mentioned, I don't have a lot of time left, but you mentioned Valerie Plame and Brewster Jennings. We know, or at least we think we know, that she was that Brewster Jennings was involved in counter nuclear proliferation involving Iran.
Correct. Not only Iran.
Not only Iran. So
not only Iran. I'm not at any liberties of, but we are looking at several countries. It's not only Iran. You're looking at least four countries.
Well, I certainly wish we had more time today. We don't. I'd like to invite you back on at a later date to go in some of this in more detail. I've got
time. And I hope you will mention the recent activities within the Congress by people like Senator Santorum and Conrad Burns and Senator Bonds, who are trying to make these gag orders on whistleblowers worse by passing this legislation that will make it illegal for intelligence agencies and law enforcement employees to talk to press or even go to Congress and disclose information like government waste, fraud, abuse. So these are some critical times, and I hope that you can cover these important issues when they are sending this chilling message to any potential whistleblowers, saying that, you know, we are going to come after you, and you're going to do so lawfully by having these so-called senators passing laws legitimizing retaliations against whistleblowers.
Well, that's the idea, to make everything as secret as possible so they can do anything they want to do. Your website, nswbc.org?
Correct. That's our organization's website, and I have a personal website, is www.justacitizen.com.
Justacitizen.com?
I am a citizen, only a citizen.
Okay. All right. Well, Sibel, thank you so much for being on the Guy James Show today, and we will get in touch with you, have you back again. There are many chapters to your story, I know. And a couple of them we'd like to talk to in depth. And I do thank you so very much for being our guest today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sibel Edmond, we could devote several two-hour shows, the entire shows, to the story that she has to tell. It's very deep, extremely deep, and she, even today, is not at liberty to talk about the whole thing because of this gag order being put on her, as she said, and it is true. I've been checking up on that. She is probably the most gagged ordinary citizen that's ever lived in this country under gag orders. And Ashcroft started it, and Gonzalez has kept it up and made it even worse. And as she mentioned, some of our esteemed Republican senators are doing all they can to make it even worse. The idea being to shut up anybody that has anything to say that might make this administration look bad. That's a hell of a note when we live in a country that's supposed to be the freest country in the nation. We have free speech. And here's a woman that's got a story to tell that would do nothing but help us in our counterterrorism activities. And she's not allowed to tell it because it might make somebody look bad in the Justice Department or the FBI or the NSA or even in the White House. But that's how it is. That's how this administration has acted from day one. Attack the messenger. Attack, attack, attack the messenger. And here we had a woman doing her job, doing what she was hired to do, saw wrongdoing, reported it, and look what's happened to her in the meantime. Lost her job and has gone through hell and back over this story and forbidden to even talk about most of it. It is an amazing story, but there are many amazing stories that have happened in this Bush administration concerning secrecy. No administration has ever loved secrecy quite like this administration has. I've never seen anything like it. I don't think anybody has. And, the last time I saw Gonzalez in front of a Senate panel, you know, he just sits right there defiant and says, we're going to keep it up. We're going to have our way. We're going to, you know, he doesn't say it in those exact words, but that innocent little smirk he has on his face, he's always more than happy to let the Senate committee know that it's their business and nobody else's business, and if they don't want you to know about it, you're not going to know about it, that every secret's going to stay within the White House. And that's just the way it is in this administration. Shame on them. I'm very, very ashamed of this administration. Well, we're going to stop for news at the top of the hour. You're listening to the Guy James Show, hour number one. We're going to be back with hour number two right after the news. We're going to have Randall Hammoud on. You're going to love hearing what he has to say. So don't go away.
This is the Quality News Network. Connecticut Democratic Senator Joe Lieberman has lost his primary bid for renomination, but says he'll stay in the race as an independent. Two other members of Congress lost their seats yesterday, Georgia Democrat Cynthia McKinney and Michigan Republican Joe Schwartz. The Israeli Security Cabinet has voted to expand its ground offensive in southern Lebanon, sending thousands more troops as far north as the Litani River. That's about 18 miles north of the border. Efforts to get humanitarian aid into that area have been stalled because of Israel's ban on any road travel there. The UN's World Food Program has been asking Israel since Monday to guarantee safe passage, but as yet has not received it. Israeli jets continue to conduct new bombing raids on Lebanon today, while Hezbollah fired another 130 rockets into Israel. So far, it's estimated that nearly 1,000 Lebanese and 100 Israelis have been killed. UN diplomats still trying to revise a draft resolution to end the conflict. A vote could come tomorrow. In Iraq, the search continues for two U.S. soldiers missing since their Army Black Hawk helicopter crashed yesterday in the Anbar province west of Baghdad. Four other crew members were rescued and are in stable condition. The next phase in the plan to bring more U.S. and Iraqi troops into Baghdad is now underway. 50,000 troops are already there. Phase two brings another 6,000 Iraqi troops and 3,500 American forces to the capital, all in an effort to stem the continuing violence. Four Iraqis are under arrest in Baghdad for the January kidnapping of American freelance reporter Jill Carroll. She was released unharmed after nearly 3 months. A new CNN poll finds that 60% of Americans now oppose the war in Iraq, and an equal number think U.S. troop withdrawals should begin by the end of this year. Immigration officials and the FBI are looking for 10 young Egyptian men in the U.S. on student visas to attend school at Montana State University. They arrived at JFK International Airport 10 days ago, part of a group of 17. Six of them made it to Montana. One was picked up today in Minneapolis. The others are still missing. The Cuban government is signaling a crackdown on black market satellite dishes used by its citizens to get American TV news and programming. It's estimated there are 10,000 illegal dishes in Cuba. More than 500 people are now believed to have died in eastern Ethiopia's flash flooding last weekend. In Sri Lanka, the fighting continues, but the Tamil Tigers have lifted their blockade of an irrigation reservoir. The water is once again flowing to thousands of farmers for the first time in 3 weeks. And Nepal's government and communist rebels have agreed to lock up their weapons and resume a peace process that has been on the verge of collapse. This is the Quality News Network.
Most people would rather have a root canal than go to a dealer to buy a car. But you can turn dread into joy when you learn how to play the car buying game. Read the book, Right Car, Right Price, and you'll discover how the game is played and how you can win every time. Whether you're buying a car or a truck, new or used, Right Car, Right Price explains how to find and buy the vehicle best suited to your individual transportation needs. Auto Week called Right Car, Right Price the right stuff. So take the hassle out of car buying. Read Right Car, Right Price, and every time you get into your new car, you'll know you've got a great deal. Go online to rightcarrightprice.com to order your copy today. It only takes an hour to read Right Car, Right Price, and it just costs $10. We even pay the postage. So go to rightcarrightprice.com right now. It'll be one of the best decisions you ever make.
U.S. mortgage applications rebounded last week, up 4.9% from the previous week's four-year low. The nation's largest luxury home builder, Toll Brothers, says its third-quarter sales dropped as the housing market continued its downward trend. The Disney company reports higher third-quarter revenue and profits. Net income was $1.1 billion. The major U.S. airlines are reducing fares on select leisure travel routes, but unrestricted fares remain unchanged. The NFL has named Roger Goodell as its next commissioner, succeeding his boss, Paul Tagliabue. Adidas says its second-quarter net profit rose by 24% thanks to this year's World Cup soccer championships. A new report says that among the world's major cities, Oslo and London are the most expensive, followed by Copenhagen, Zurich, and Tokyo. The cheapest are Kuala Lumpur and Mumbai. And Google will soon begin scanning several million of the University of California library's 34 million titles. It's all part of a project to make major library collections searchable online. Gold is trading at $663.70 an ounce this hour. Lightspeed crude is up 79 cents, $77.10 a barrel. Trading is mixed on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials are down 24 points at 11,149. NASDAQ is up 22 to 2,082, and the S&P 500 is up 4 at 1,275. More at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Diana Walter. It's now 5 minutes past the hour.
God bless America.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you've read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Welcome back, everybody. I hope you had a chance to go out and get a cool drink during the news there. See, the price of oil's going up again today. Oh, joy. How long will it be until you're going to be paying for that at the gas pump? Probably about tomorrow. I know ours is starting to go up already here. You are listening to the Guy James Show. We are very glad to have all of you along with us this afternoon. I see we've got a good audience with us this afternoon. And as promised, right now I'm going to get right to it. I promised to have with us today Randall Hammoud. He is a very interesting guy. We'll give you some places where you can go look at his biography. But he's been on the O'Reilly Factor. I'm going to have to ask him how well he got along with Bill. He's been on the Dan Abrams Show, the Catherine Cryer Show, I believe it was on the Catherine Cryer Show. He's telling me he was, now I've forgotten the guy's name. He would be mad. Anyway, Randall, are you with me?
Yes, I am. I think you're talking about Alan Dershowitz.
Yes. How could I forget? I was watching Alan Dershowitz with John Zogby last night, and I thought Alan got a bit carried away. Anyway.
Yeah, he tends to do that. When I debated him back in 2001, he was advocating the torture of detainees. And
yeah.
I was, of course, opposing that. And he seemed more prescient than what was actually going to happen from that time until this time. But I think I was more correct.
Well, he's, I don't know. You know, I used to think that he was, maybe I was wrong. Maybe I just didn't see enough of him. But I used to think he was a fairly rational guy. But the last few things that I've heard him talk about, he's been off the deep end to me, and he got rather belligerent last night, I thought, talking about what's going on in the Israeli conflict. Glad to have you along with us this afternoon. You've got an interesting bio, and first, if you would, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm American-born, Lebanese-American, secularized Muslim. Born in Los Angeles, UCLA Law School graduate, been practicing law since 1971. And I got caught up in all of this current event concerning the war on terrorism, et cetera, because in September 2001, when they arrested three young Arab Muslim men in San Diego, California, because they had been acquainted with two of the 911 hijackers who had visited San Diego in the year 2000, I came to defend the three young men who were arrested as material witnesses and taken to New York testimony.
All right, so you've...
I got caught up in Ground Zero within a few weeks after that terrible day.
Yes, indeed.
And I've been in that whole scenario ever since.
Well...
In Arabs and Muslims and civil rights, speaking out against the Patriot Act, and what I consider to be the excesses of the Bush administration relative to its waging of a domestic and international war on terrorism.
I hadn't noticed any excesses. You know, originally when we first spoke today, the reason I first called you today is I had read your statement about our actions in the Middle East causing many more bin Ladens, and I was hoping that you'd first explain that to your audience, and then to our audience, and then I want to talk to you about this beautiful friendship article you were telling me about.
Well, I think what I've been saying, and what bin Laden has been saying to give him traction in the Middle East, is the United States has been supporting the autocratic Arab regimes throughout the Arab world, been unduly biased towards Israel and the Israel-Palestine problem, has been supporting through the presence of military forces and propping up, the autocratic regimes of the Middle East, and also has stationed troops throughout Saudi Arabia, initially, and the Middle East, to the chagrin of bin Laden and a lot of Muslims who feel that there shouldn't be any foreign or Christian troops, more specifically in Saudi Arabia, the birthplace of Islam. And so the policies, I think, the United States have triggered a lot of alienation among the Arab and Islamic world, and people like bin Laden come along, and they have a lot of appeal when the governments of those venues repress any moderation or moderate discussion of those policies or the right of people to express themselves. Ironically, when bin Laden comes out with a videotape and speaks to these issues, he's speaking more freely than most of the population in the Middle East can speak about those issues in their own country. So he became, I think, basically quite the poster boy for a lot of the grievances of the Middle East. And I think the grievances could be made to go away if we temper and tinker with our policies, become more of a fair arbiter in the Palestine-Israel scenario, and do less to support autocratic regimes in the area and more to encourage democracy, development of trade unions, the free press, the institutions that prop up democracies in the long term. And so that was my position, that we needed to avoid at all costs putting religious patina on our policies and our actions in the Middle East for fear of provoking some sort of a holy war between Islam and Christianity and Judaism. And now I think what we've done with the Iraq invasion and the President Bush's actions, or rather inaction since the Lebanon tragedy, as is currently being inflicted upon Lebanon by Israel, I think it's morphing into what is perceived to be a holy war by millions of Muslims throughout the world, and it's a very dangerous place now. It's a much more dangerous world than when President Bush took over.
I heartily agree, and I think so many people have the wrong idea about bin Laden and al-Qaeda. I think so many people, particularly on the right, have this idea that al-Qaeda is this massive, well-organized entity, this army that's out there, when in fact I think it's more of an idea with the figurehead being bin Laden, and it's for my money, it will do no good at this point to find him and kill him. I think the damage has already been done, and there are going to be many more bin Laden sprouting up everywhere.
Well, I think if he were to be found and killed by Western forces, he'd be martyred, so I think he'd be basically viewed as a hero down the line. If he were to be captured and think tried for his crimes by an Islamic court, I think that would go a long ways towards discrediting him. Because after all, you know, he was an admitted participant in the killing of 3,000 Americans, and there is a debt that has to be paid. But I think you're correct. Al-Qaeda now is it's an image. People espouse loyalty to bin Laden and to Al-Qaeda, but they're self-starters, a lot of them. They're indigenous insurgencies and or cells, for lack of a better definition, throughout different parts of the world. And their whole goal, I think, is basically they're trying to seek a release, I think, from autocracy in most places where they exist. And, you know, he's, I'm afraid, become their hero. And we've made him more of the hero by, I think, not capturing him.
Certainly.
And letting him assume mythical proportions, frankly.
Well, I think part of the reasons that we're having the problem, and I want to get into that in a little bit, part of the reason we're having this problem that we're having with the Iraqi Hezbollah is that Americans now have this perception, and I know they do from the polls I've seen, that that almost all Muslims are some sort of fundamentalist radicals. And that's the way they see it. Therefore, Israel good, Arabs bad. I think that's the way Americans are looking at this story because of the massive backing from our Congress and from religious organizers here in this country, all backing every last move that Israel does. And I think, and anyway, it's my idea that I think they do that because they see the entire Arab world as being absolutely bad, and they think all Muslims are some sort of radical crazies. Do you agree?
Well, I mean, there's that perception. I think they just took a poll last year that 46% of Americans at that time thought the Islamic religion was a violent religion. The vast majority of Muslims are basically temperate. They're not extreme. You can see in the leadership of the various Arab countries, they wear suits, they don't wear beards, they talk rationally, their press talks rationally. But what's happening is with the graphic imagery of innocent civilians being pulverized in Lebanon, and Israel's want and penchant for going into Palestinian territories as well and having their way to Palestinian people, it's tempering the moderates even, where if they speak up, they'll be perceived to be an ally of the United States and or Israel, who are considered to be one these days in the Middle East. And the extremist view comes to the forefront, and it becomes a we they. It's a survival thing. You have to be an extremist. You have to be completely devoted to the religion and to the defense of the religion. Otherwise, we're going to be victimized by what they perceive to be this Judeo-Christian crusade that's being practiced upon the Middle East now, and that Bin Laden's been beating the drums about since 1994.
Yes. Well, a lot of people don't like to look at history and see that Bin Laden really is a creation of some of the events that have happened in the Middle East. We would never have heard of Bin Laden had it not been for some things that have happened in the Middle East. I wanted to turn to an article that you told me about called A Beautiful Friendship by Glenn Frankel. And I would like for all of our listeners, let me see here. It's at the Washington Post. Just search A Beautiful Friendship by Glenn Frankel, and you'll find this on here. Randall told me about it, and I had a chance to go over it this afternoon. And it's an amazing story of how the Israeli influence here in this country has grown from nothing to an all-powerful, and I mean all-powerful, entity here in this country. And I think it's causing us problems right now. Do you agree?
I agree, because I think as Senator Chuck Hagel said a few days ago, it may not be in the national interest of the United States to be joined at the hip with Israel and Israel's perception of its national interest in the Middle East, per se. And we need to step back and define the national interest of the United States in terms of our security rather than in terms of the president's faith or the revelation predictions of the Bible or the fundamentalist Christian viewpoint of what these current events may signify from a biblical predictive standpoint, and get down to realpolitik. Our national interests really dictate an immediate ceasefire in Lebanon and peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Because short of that area is so subject to conflagration and so disruptive of the international economy that we can't afford violence over there, not even one day's violence. I was very disappointed in the sense that the Bush administration was not want to seek a ceasefire immediately and was wanting to let this play out. And the violence is becoming ramped up and elevated, and the antagonism toward the United States for allowing Israel to proceed this way and for speeding up the deliveries of bombs to Israel now has caused the United States security interests, I think, to suffer probably irreparably because of this activity that's going on today.
I personally don't think
people's advice have been followed. We basically sit back and say, well, what's in it for us? What do we need to do as a country to protect our people here and to protect the world and make it a safer place? That's what the United States has to start asking itself, not what Tel Aviv thinks of the world.
Well, I don't think this administration is interested in our standing in the world. I really don't. They've shown all sorts of evidence that they don't really give a damn what the rest of the nations think about us, or some of these things wouldn't be happening. You know, this AIPAC group, for example, here in this country. I don't think people understand just how powerful the Israeli lobby is here in Washington. A very, very powerful organization. You know all about AIPAC. In fact, I was surprised you told me today something I did not know, and I bet a lot of our listeners didn't know, that Wolf Blitzer was at one time on the staff of the Israeli lobby, AIPAC. Had no idea about that. I guess that's something you'd probably not like to talk about, since he's doing news today and trying to remain neutral on this. But
well, he hasn't been, because he's been hammering the heck out of the Arabs in Lebanon and
yeah.
the CNN presentation. They have a lot of the media here since the inception of the latest tragedy in the Middle East. I mean, Israel's played up too much in the news as the victim, and you know, Lebanon's the victim, and the Lebanese are the victims here.
Well,
this is something that we talked about and vetted by everybody. AIPAC does exist. It's most influential in this country. It can be read about in the Washington Post and other places. And the tendency is for people who bring up these subjects and who criticize Israel, not even just people like me, but generally most people, they're depicted as possibly being anti-Semitic or accused of being anti-Semitic. I'm an Arab, I'm a Semite, so I don't really wear that mantle very well. But the facts speak for themselves, and that Washington Post article is very telling as to AIPAC power in this country. And American people have to ask themselves, should any lobby have such power over our foreign policy?
Oh, absolutely. And they've gotten involved, very involved in domestic politics in this country. And many people think they're just as powerful in the same manner as the National Rifle Association, where they interject themselves into domestic politics in this country. It tells the story in there about how they had it in for Republican Paul Findley of Illinois and Pete McCloskey of California and Charles Percy, and just ran them out of town on a rail by backing their foes and got them thrown out of office.
Well, they're very effective. Any politician in this country at any level who says or votes against Israel or says anything against Israel's policies is going to receive direct attention from AIPAC and large numbers of dollars flowing into his or her district on behalf of opponents who disagree with him about the Israel question. And this is life in the big city to the United States and in the small towns and across the country. This is what happens. There is no really freedom of discussion about Israel and Israeli politics and policies among our politicians, because they're very much afraid of the consequences if they say the wrong thing.
Well, AIPAC,
right.
you might understand why it's that way. AIPAC, I was shocked by some of this. AIPAC has a staff of 200 lobbyists and a budget of $47 million and 100,000 grassroots members. They have recruitment going on 300 college campuses. AIPAC and their donors delivered $56.8 million in individual group and soft money donations to federal candidates since 1990. And by contrast, the Arab and pro-Muslim groups have donated a mere $297,000. So there's a great disparity in the money going on there.
Yeah, there's a great disparity in the telling of the story, too. There really is.
Well, it seems to be directly related.
Well, I think there it is. That's how our system works in the country.
Well, how do
money
we get out
mother,
to...
Money is still the mother's milk of politics. Someone said that out here in California years ago.
Yes, yes.
He was right about that.
Well, how we? What do you see as any kind of a settlement? We've had several ideas thrown forth now to try and settle this current conflict. Personally, I think it's a long ways from being over. I hope I'm proven wrong. I think it's a long way from being over in between Israel and Lebanon, because I think that Israel is being used as a proxy by the United States government, the Bush administration, to sucker Syria somehow into coming into the conflict and then giving us all the reason we need to go after Syria and Iran. Maybe I'm being far-fetched with that, but I can certainly see that happening. How do you see this playing out?
Well, I think that there is an agenda that has been described by the pundits in the Pentagon, where they want to go after Syria and Iran. And there is a proxy war right now. They claim that the Hezbollah is a proxy for Iran, but Israel is a proxy for the United States. President Bush specifically hasn't sought a ceasefire to let the Israelis continue to what he calls punish destroy Hezbollah, and just the opposite is occurring. Basically, the past 26 days, I think it's been, the Lebanon conflagration started, has resulted in Hezbollah and Sheikh Nasrallah becoming the heroes throughout the Arab and Islamic world. It's created thousands and thousands of new jihadis who want to go to Lebanon and fight Israel and join Hezbollah. It's helped stab over, very much so, the schism between Sunni Islam and Shiite Islam, where the Sunni countries and the Sunni Arab street are most in favor and supportive of Hezbollah and the Shiites for the gallant fight they're putting up against the once omnipotent Israeli army. And the tragedy of all this is Israel's not learning anything. Israel still thinks might is right, and she has to stop and think and step back herself. 3,100 rockets have landed on her northern portions of her country in the past 26 days from an asymmetrical, militarily disadvantaged, supposedly technologically inferior force that they can't seem to ferret out. And another 12 to 15 miles to the Lachani River won't change a thing because the missiles go anywhere up to 50, 60 miles so far, maybe even farther. You know, Israel has to understand that might isn't going to solve the problem. Peace will solve the problem to give Israel security, but not their armament, because obviously the armaments have not done them any good. They go in and punish them. They move a line farther north, and the other side just gets longer missiles. And this is a very dangerous situation, because you're right. Syria and Iran could be brought into it immediately. I don't think we as a country have the horses to go into either venue. We're bogged down in Iraq as it is.
Absolutely. Men and material. We're in bad shape right now. Our military is being decimated. I don't know.
Iraq's a civil war. Everybody tells you that it's not. They're lying. It's a civil war.
Well, we read a letter yesterday from one of our troops that's over there right now, and he said it's exactly that. He's there. He's in Baghdad, and he was telling us about it. It is a civil war.
Yeah, I have soldiers I know over there, too. They're in the middle of it.
Yeah.
And those boys and girls shouldn't be in that situation.
Well, there's a lot of people think that AIPAC did all they could to get us involved in Iraq. And, of course, it mentioned that in that article that we were talking about.
Well, there is that. And then the neocons who really stirred the drink, the straws that were stirring the Iraq war drink, or, you know, Wolfowitz, Pearl, and Douglas Faith, and they all proposed the Iraq invasion to Israel back in 1996.
Yes.
And it proposed it to the Likud party. And
of course, they had all that good intelligence from Shalabi and the curveball.
We're relying on an intelligence source called curveball. Nobody starts to think, well, maybe he's throwing us curveballs.
Yeah, I had to wonder about that one.
That's so humorous. I have trouble. Even the Germans were trying to tell us, look, don't trust this guy, you know.
I know, yeah.
And, it's just...
I'm
afraid you just have to say that the Bush administration has been more than, shall we say, a little amateurish in their approaches to a lot of these things.
Amateurish, and that's turned out to be very dangerous. And, you know, I want to give some of you folks that won't get a chance to see this article that Randall told me about, just to give you an idea that how far the Israeli lobby has come in this country. There's a story in there about David Ben-Gurion, and you all know who he was. He wanted 15 minutes of Franklin Roosevelt's time. And he came to Washington, D.C. He rented a two-room suite at the old Ambassador Hotel and stayed there for 10 weeks writing letters and reports and making passes at his secretary, said anyway. But he never did get to meet with Franklin Roosevelt. Never. And David Ben-Gurion is a famous Israeli. Now, we fast forward 64 years, and Omer comes to Washington. He gets more time with the president than anybody gets. He gets to give a speech in front of Congress. My, how things have changed over the years.
Yeah, I wish we had Arab tact, but we don't.
It's just.
It would be nice to have a little even playing field here as far as getting the truth out.
Well, it's not even, and We're facing a terrible humanitarian mess in Lebanon right now. Supplies are being denied them. It's going to be decades before that poor country is rebuilt. They don't have the money to do it. I don't know who will end up rebuilding it. It certainly won't be Israel. It may well be United States taxpayers. I don't know. But it's a terrible thing that could easily get very quickly out of hand, and I'm ashamed of our government the way they're handling it right now.
Well, the U.S. taxpayers are underwriting the Israel military and the weapons being dropped on Lebanon, and perhaps the magnanimity demands that they also underwrite the rebuilding of Lebanon.
Yeah.
You know, we've been part and parcel this whole past 26 days, and basically are viewed as a co-conspirator with Israel and by the Arab world. In the Muslim world, and you know, if we want to reestablish some credentials, once this stops and the dust settles, we've got a long ways to go here. A long ways.
Well, we drew this circle last week on the program. We were talking about the irony of this whole situation. Here we are in Iraq. We've spent almost 2,600 lives of our young kids over there, 300 and some odd billion dollars. To give those folks freedom, the administration is saying, we've armed Israel to the teeth, who in turn is destroying the entire nation of Lebanon, and we will have to probably pay for a good bit of that bill. And then the government that we've installed in Iraq is saying how much they hate Israel. We're involved in such a bizarre situation. It's something I could never have dreamed up. You couldn't write something like this. You really couldn't.
Well, it's surrealistic because in Iraq, we're placating and supporting the Shiites, Ayatollah Sistani, and the Shiite 60% Shiite population in Iraq. In Lebanon, we're making war with Israel on the Shiite population of 700,000 Shiites in South Lebanon. And we threaten Syria, which is led by Shiites, and we, of course, threaten Iran, which is governed by Shiites, and basically consists of 65 million Shiites. So we really, we have a very schizophrenic view of the Islamic world and Shiism in this country as a matter of foreign policy.
We sure do.
And we're not going to be trusted by anybody.
Well, it always tickles me
in
when...
that part of the world.
Well, exactly. But you know, it always tickles me when some of these people say, well, you know, those Muslims, they're all... And I hear some of these evangelical preachers talking about it, the ones that aren't wanting to bring on Armageddon. They're talking about well, the Muslims, you know, they're very radical. We Christians, we're good people, and the Muslims are radical. I guess everybody that says that there aren't any radicals in Christendom never been down in Appalachia and seen any of these people do these snake dances. There's radicals everywhere. Every religion, I could name you a group of radicals within it, but it's just bizarre that how all of a sudden in this country all the Muslims have turned into radicals, and it's a shame. It is. Randall, I want to thank you so much for being on the program again, for the first time today, and I appreciate that very, very much. You've given some insight into your views and some new views that we haven't considered before. I do appreciate your time very much. Thank you
for having me on the show. And the book's available on Amazon.
Oh yeah, let's do that. Now, first of all, let's tell us about the book and just how they can.
Well, the book's entitled "Osama Bin Laden, America's Enemy in His Own Words." It depicts in English 20 of his statements between 1994 and 2004, including the statement of October 29, 2004, when he talked about how the Lebanese bombing of 1982 and shelling of Lebanon and Beirut of 1982 gave him the idea for destroying the towers or towers in America as payback for what he considered to be that transgression. And I was trying to glean from his own words nuggets of strategies whereby we could discredit his message and discredit him and keep the war on terrorism focused as a secular war to secular targets such as Mr. Bin Laden and not morph the war on terrorism into a religious war, which we could never possibly want to engage in or would ever win, really.
Yes.
And I'm afraid that, you know, there are a lot of I told you so's to be read in the book based upon the policies today. And the book was published in September of 2005, so it's been a year almost. And I'm afraid the situation is deteriorating, maybe exponentially with this latest foray into Lebanon by Israel and the reaction to it throughout the Middle East, throughout the Islamic world.
Yeah, it wouldn't take much to set off a horrible situation there.
Not at all, exactly. And, you know, we just had BP Arco take 8% of our daily oil production offline. Saudi Arabia stated it'll step in and increase production to try to make up the difference. But it's going to be much more expensive oil for Americans here, especially on our West Coast, because you're on the East Coast, because I used to be a lawyer with ARCO, and our main West Coast refineries are tuned to Alaska oil, and so they're more efficient at basically distilling the oil into the gasoline. When they use foreign mixes, there will be increases in prices and cost of transportation. But if there's a conflagration in the Middle East involving Iran and the Straits of Hormuz are closed, then the oil spigot is turned off at the point of source. Oil would probably be $100 overnight.
Yeah, that's 20% of the world's oil comes right through there, and God only knows how many men it would take to protect the Straits of Hormuz to allow ships to come through there. I don't think we have that many people.
Well, that's why when there's any kind of flame in the Middle East, you want to blow it out really quickly. You want an immediate ceasefire. You don't want it to pick up more kindling wood and some more, you know, larger pieces of wood and increase in intensity as this situation in Lebanon's been increasing since July 12th because it's a tinderbox over there. And once it gets going, bad things happen worldwide. People don't remember, but the 1973 oil embargo that involved just the Middle East producers had a profound effect on our economy for the next 5, maybe 10 years after that.
Yes.
You know, interest rates hit 18% to 20% under Carter after that time. So,
that's right. That's right.
So you want peace and quiet over there. You really don't need, you know, brush fires starting because they become conflagrations too easily.
Name of the book again?
And in the book, it's Osama bin Laden, America's Enemy in Its Own Words. And I say in the book, let's get alternative sources of energy because if oil were $5 or $6 a barrel, there probably wouldn't be any money for any terrorists.
You're right about that.
And that's true. It's still true today.
Hey, we could write a book of I Told You So's about the Bush administration and be pretty doggone thick, I think.
Oh, well. What's frightening about that is that they're still creating I Told You So.
Yes. Haven't learned a thing. Haven't learned
that's
a thing.
True. Absolutely not.
Randall, thanks so much for being on the program
today.
Thanks
for having me. I appreciate it. Have a pleasant day.
Yeah. Bye now.
Bye now.
I forgot to mention that. He has been a lawyer for oil companies. He's been around. He knows the Middle East very, very well and has a tremendous grasp. What do you think? I wonder if anybody, have you been following this close enough? Are some of you bored by the Middle East conflagration that's taking place right now? Do you understand that if something just falls the wrong place at the wrong time over there, we could be looking at the Third World War? Does everybody understand that? I'm sure my listeners all understand that. I'm not sure the American public does understand that. Do you think they do? I think the American public has got every right now to be scared to death of this situation. I honestly do believe, and my ideas on this are buttressed more and more every single day, shored up every day by our State Department, by the statements of Bush when he has a statement about it, by Condoleezza Rice's statements, by Rumsfeld's statement. Nothing that comes from this government right now gives me any confidence whatsoever about that entire situation over there. I honestly do believe, and I'm, as you know, I am not a conspiracy theorist. I am not involved in that. I always look at them and make my own choice about them, but I haven't seen anything that's terribly convincing about some of the conspiracies. But I really do believe that the Bush administration and the PNAC people in particular are the driving force behind this, with Dick Cheney, that they are salivating over the fact that they might now have a chance to take on Syria and Iran. I really believe that's what they're after. It would take a real hard argument to talk me out of that. There's no military other than blowing up a bridge or two or a highway to keep supplies from coming in and out of Syria. There is no big reason for a bunch of troops the other night to have been up on the northeast border of Lebanon, staring across the line at Syria. They are trying to goad Syria into some sort of a military conflict, and I will bet you that the moment they do, Big Brother, and I'm talking Big Brother, I'm talking about Israel's Big Brother, Uncle Sam, is going to be there, and the Bush boys are going to say, hey, folks, they attacked our friends, the Israelis, and now we've got to go after Israel. We've got to go after Syria. We've got to go to Damascus, and we've got to go to Tehran. I really, honest to God, believe that's what's going on right now. I really do. I think they're hoping and praying that that happens. First of all, they've got their plans to take the control of the entire Middle East. There's no question, no question, but what the PNAC folks want to take control of that entire region, all of it, every last bit of it. Get our military power over there so that we can drive the ships, so to speak. I really think that's what they're trying to do. Iran's sitting on a huge, huge amount of reserves, oil reserves. Huge. That this country wants. Make no mistake about it. And if they can start... And you think of the political end of it. Look at how everybody backed George Bush when we went into Afghanistan. What was it? His popularity shot up to 80%, 90%, whatever it was. I want you to know I was never counted as one of those. Never. I saw this coming. But if he starts another war with Syria and Iran, will the Republicans rise up once again and say, see, we're looking out for you folks. God bless America. Everybody put those little flags on your cars and those little ribbons, and let's go after them, those dirty Arabs. Let's go get them. Is that what they're after? Hey, they'll use any argument. Any argument. We'll be back in a minute.
They're going to lose. It's as simple as that. The same way we are losing in Iraq, they're going to lose in Lebanon in the big picture now. I don't mean in the short term. In the long term, the only thing that could make a difference is a devastating, catastrophic, overwhelming victory for the Israelis, where nothing is left living in southern Lebanon, south of the Litani River. I have nothing more to say on the issue. Either Israel wants to live, and Israel frees itself of the Holocaust mentality, and Israel frees itself of the men who are acting as though they are still hiding in the sewers of Warsaw instead of walking in the clear light of Tel Aviv. And if they want to act like Holocaust Jews hiding in the sewer, I cannot change the psyche of the leadership of Israel. I can't do it. If they want to act like Sabres who were born in the Mediterranean and belong there and are willing to fight for it and use all the power they have and crush the bastards to get it over with right to the Litani River, well, so be it. But they're not willing to do that. Therefore, they're going to lose. So I have nothing more to say about it. Don't you understand? And therefore, in the long run, the sands of the Middle East will sweep over the Jewish state, and it will disappear within not your lifetime, perhaps, but eventually the sands will reconquer what the Israelis built out of the sands, out of the desert sands. And once again, the Arabs will be happy as they go back to their nomadic ways of cutting each other's throat.
World, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Don't Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Yeah, my blood's so mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here just contemplating. I can't twist the truth, it knows no regulation. Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Think of all the hate there is in Red China, then take a look around to Selma, Alabama. You may leave here for 4 days in space, but when you return, it's the same old place. The pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to say grace. And tell me over and over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. No, no, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
We're not going to play around. We do have your phone. And if you say anything untoward, obscene, or anything like that, we'll contact your local authorities and you will be held accountable.
Why, you ill-mannered sack of crap!
Tell us what you think. Call Guy James now. 1-866-546-5254.
What, is your telephones out of order today? Is that the problem? Is the phone lines down everywhere? I know mine's a working. Hey, give us a call, 866-546-5254. That's an order. We need your calls. I heard Condi Rice the other day. You know, I get so damned. There's certain people that I see on TV. She's one. And all you feminists, hey, I love women. It's not got anything to do with the fact that she's a woman. I just can't stand her. I just can't stand to see her talk. There's something about when that woman talks, it just infuriates me. First of all, I know she's a smart woman. I know she is. And that's probably what infuriates me. Here is a smart woman up there mouthing the constant platitudes coming from from Dick Cheney, probably, marches in lockstep with those people no matter. She could not possibly believe some of the things she says. She couldn't. You know, I heard her talking a while back. She said Dean Acheson was her hero. You know, I've read my history on Dean Acheson, and I can't remember what year it was. But he had a famous speech that he gave a group of folks and said that good and evil that the idea that good and evil couldn't coexist in the world was the height of absurdity. And it is. Good and evil have coexisted on this planet ever since Adam and Eve left the Garden of Eden. And given the historical record, and one might add nuclear weapons. This coexistence of good and evil had to continue. And evil and tyranny will never, ever be eradicated from this earth. Never. Never. Evil is rooted in human nature, and that cannot be changed. You can contain it, but you can't change it. As long as there are human beings on this planet, there will be evil. And so the right-wingers, when they come up with this thing, is, oh, we're going to rid the world of terror and evil. Oh, bullshit. That's absurd. Just absolutely absurd. Like I said, you can contain it. You can't put it out. You'll never, ever do away with evil on this earth. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hey, good afternoon, Guy. Bill from Toledo.
Hi, Bill.
Hey, you had two excellent guests on there in a row.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed both of them.
And I kind of don't know where to start today with the Middle East flaring up the way it is and nothing being done about it. I started out today, you know, with your two guests. I wanted to talk about the Lieberman and vote there in Connecticut. But now, I don't know, maybe this is going to be a turnaround. What do you think?
Well, for the party?
Yeah, with the vote. And I kind of think that maybe this is going to put some fire under some Democrats. I'm not worried about the Republicans. I'm worried about my own party.
Exactly right. I hope a few of them start looking over their shoulder and say, hey, maybe I better pay attention to the electorate. Maybe I better start listening to what my rank and file Democrats back home have to say. I think that's the message that went out last night. And if you know, a lot of people don't like to hear that word, but I am for some, at least some party purity. I am for purging some folks from the party. And
you're absolutely right there, Guy. Listen, I wanted to say, I don't know if this war had this big a thing to do with Lieberman losing last night as we think. Because I think maybe from what I heard last night, there might be something else involved in this.
Well, there's 50 reasons to get him out of there. I'm very happy about it.
Well, what I was thinking is, what I heard Chris Matthews say was they shut down his website. The bloggers, hackers.
That didn't happen.
They crashed his website. I heard he had about $15 worth of bandwidth on that.
That's exactly what happened. He had an El Cheapo server that couldn't handle the volume, and they knew it. They aren't that stupid. they aren't that stupid at all. That's an old Karl Rove trick. It went down. They caused it to go down themselves. They knew what the problem was, and they came out and said, it's the other side's fault. Oh, yeah.
Did you hear Chris Matthews making a big deal out of that?
No, I didn't. I was at a big banquet last night. And
yeah, I heard that.
And I didn't get to see Tweety what he had to say last night.
Yeah, he said he was asking Lamont there. He says, is it true that your people hacked Lieberman's website, or people that you knew, could they have stopped? Can you get them to stop? My God almighty.
Oh.
It ain't so, Joe.
Oh, man. Hey, you know, and first of all, let's say that it actually happened. It didn't, but let's say it did. Let's say one person, one side succeeded in shutting down the other one's website on election day.
Uh-huh.
What kind of effect did that have on election day?
Zilch.
The cows are in the barn by then. I mean,
absolutely.
Come on.
Listen, Guy, maybe you can and maybe you can't. There's somebody I think is possible you could get him to come on your show, and I think he would be an excellent guest.
Who is it?
It's F.W. Engdahl. It's E-N-G-D-A-L. E-N-G-D-A-H-L. And he wrote a book, A Century of War. And I've heard him interviewed before.
Okay. Okay.
And I will. You can look it up on your.
All right. Yeah, I will.
And I think he would be an excellent guest to come on. Because
well, good. Thanks for the tip. I'll search it out. Don't forget, we got John Dean on tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. Listen, I missed you yesterday. I was asleep the first time I've missed one of your shows.
Well.
And God, I don't know how long. But I missed you. And then somehow White Rose, it didn't come through.
Well, Ben's working on that from what I understand, so he might get
but,
it up.
Anyway, I hated to miss it. I really wanted to hear it yesterday.
All right. Well, I'm taking one of the gold stars off your chart.
Listen, Guy, I'm going to let you go. Maybe you can get one more other caller.
All righty. Thank you.
It's glad to hear you back, and keep those good guests coming.
Thanks.
On.
Bye now.
Okay, Guy.
And let's see who we got over on this line. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
You got California Dave.
Hi, Dave. How are you doing?
Pretty fair. Once again, I meant to let you know that one can only hear your side of the conversation when on hold. So you said there's an adjustment for it, but it hasn't worked yet.
Hmm.
But, you know, I was responding. I love both the interviews. I wish you could have taken more on as to the role of 911 for both of them. But good and bad in people. You know, I think there have been, we've been fortunate, some really wonderful people that have even gained leadership in our country that have acted in the best interest of the people. And that's so lacking right now. What we have now is just, you know, I'd say evil, hardcore criminals, psychopaths, willing to do anything to enhance their own pocketbook.
Yes.
But,
I agree. And Dave, the bad part about it is, you know, throughout history, we found a bad apple or two in Washington in an administration. Here we've got a bushel full of them.
They could never have gotten there. Honestly, they had to rig the election. That's the only way we get a group like this.
Well, you know, we were talking about that last night at this banquet. I was at the table. I was at. We were talking about it. Probably nothing ever going to be done about it seriously until the Republicans think they've been bitten by it. And you know, the first time they lose a close election, they're going to scream, and then maybe something will be done. I don't know.
Well, I think we just saw two examples, and I don't know what the third one was yesterday, but Connecticut votes on the old time, put the little cardboard in there and poke a hole in it, and Georgia operates on the electronic machines. You know, Cynthia McKinney, with all of her personality and abrasiveness, she takes this administration on very directly. I mean, she will take a bite right out of the tiger's butt, and she accuses them of a lot of what I believe they are guilty of. So, for that reason, I like the lady. You know, all in all, I tolerate a few of the rough edges. She was voted out on Diebold machines, meaning the cons didn't want her, which I thought, well, that's going to make Guy love this lady.
No, I've never been a fan of her. She's a little too rough around the edges for me, but I hope this guy that's going to take her place, I hope he is, well, first of all, I hope he can win the general election, and I think he can. I think he's probably no doubt the favorite in the general election, and if he wins, I hope he makes a good congressman. We need all the good ones we can get nowadays. God knows we've certainly got enough of them that aren't any good.
Let's hope the Diebold cons don't have to flip more than 10 or 12 million votes.
I tell you what, that's a tall order, but I believe they could get it done if they had to.
Yeah.
But once again, you know, here we go. Last night, I think the Lieberman election showed that the polls can be pretty doggone accurate. The final poll that I saw up there was practically right on the nose. So
yeah.
If we see these exit polls once again come out and be a mile off like they were last time around, we'll know they're screwing us once again.
Well, I do see the Republican candidate and Lieberman splitting their vote, and I think that it'll be the right wing that'll be voting for both of them.
Yeah, they'll put money to Lieberman. They'll do anything they can to help Lieberman get in, I think, up there. I'm pretty sure the Republicans, knowing their own candidate can't win, I bet you they throw their full support, money and all, behind Lieberman. Hey, got to run, Dave. Thank you. Good to hear from you. Oh, my. Yes, I do think that was a good thing yesterday. I do. I'm happy about it. Let me make no bones about it. I am pleased as punch, as they used to say. Hey, awfully good to have all of